From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Where does a cult end and a culture begin? What is the difference between a good organization and a bad cult? We speak this morning with Daniela Mestinick-Young, who offers nuanced insights into these questions via her own unforgettable story about being born into the Children of God cult, which is now called The Family, and then her time in the U.S. military, which she calls a cult-like organization. Her new book is called Uncultured.
Then David Bells and Sophia Maletti of the Shop Yoga Studio join us to talk about the grand reopening of the longtime Park City studio located in Old Town. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City. Stay tuned with us.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
The first rule of a cult is that you are never in a cult. These are the words of our next guest who grew up in a cult until she escaped at age 15. Daniela Mestinick-Young's new memoir, Uncultured, is a powerful story of trauma and identity. It's also the story of her time in the U.S. Army, which, though worlds apart from the cult she grew up in, still was reminiscent of being a cult for Young. Daniela Mestinick-Young, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's just start there. The first rule of a cult is that you're not in a cult. This seems to be, once you believe that everyone on the outside is wrong. Is that how it goes?
Yeah. So, you know, once I realized that I had grown up in a cult 2 years after I left, I realized it should have been so obvious because we spent so much time talking about how we were into cults. And that's actually one of the things we find when we study cults is scholars have a hard time putting a definition on cult, because as soon as you define it, a cultish group will take that definition and say, see, we're not a cult. You know, so in my life, it was Waco, David Koresh, all of that had just happened. And so the Children of God would point to that and say, see, they're a cult. He thought he was Jesus. They are wrong. We are correct. We have God's prophet. And so very much this sort of us versus them, and then the complete isolation. And you can't really see when things are going wrong.
Describe to us the Children of God. You moved with this cult all in many different places around the world, outside of the U.S., but also in the U.S.
Yeah, it started in 1968 in the U.S. during the time of late 60s, early 70s, which was social confusion, and we see cults popping up. Then our prophets spread out all around the world. So I was born in the Philippines, and then I grew up in Japan, Peru, mostly Brazil, a little bit of Mexico. And our childhoods growing up were sort of very, very controlled. I almost think it would be like being a five-year-old in basic training. You know, you get up with a reveille, you're standing in lines, you're always doing the right thing. You see your parents for like 1 hour a day when you get to be sort of free. And we worked, you know, we were a labor force for the cult. So I was an actor on videos. We would sell these videos on the street. And of course, there was all kinds of sort of brutal physical and sexual assault by which this cult is really kind of defined.
So when you got to see your parents for an hour a day, were your parents, obviously they're aware of the situation you're in, but are you pulled away, and is there money involved? Is there just threat of their life? How are your parents removed from the situation?
So my mom was born and raised in the cult as well. And I was born to her when she was a 15-year-old teenager. And so for my parents specifically, she didn't have any other experience other than you have the baby, you send her to the nursery, and you go back to your work. Now, for most of my peers' parents, the adults that joined, it's a process. You know, you get into this group, you get more isolated, you're very devoted to this mission and to this leader. And it happened kind of slowly. So the world I grew up in was much more institutionalized and strict than the world my mother had grown up in 15 years earlier. And it all just happens very slowly and nobody notices.
Oh, it's sickening. I saw a documentary where a young girl stood up and told her story about the Children of God, and and what happened to her in Brazil. And it just makes you sick. And so when you say you're making these promotional videos and these types of things, are is the government at all, I know they're aware of it, but is there any kind of act to defund these groups or to get rid of them? Or is it just kind of swept under the rug in these types of countries?
So four different countries tried to act against the Children of God, the UK and Australia being two of them. And I talk about one of the raids in Argentina in Uncultured. And it just, you know, people are sort of able to hide behind religious freedom really well. And another thing, I think why the Children of God was 10,000 people for 50 years is because they spread out all over the world. And so we are living, you know, I'm growing up, this little white blonde girl speaking English in the middle of Brazil, right? So we are living isolated in some ways, very similar to Jonestown.
You say that when, you know, when you're in a cult, there's all of this effort made to believe that you're not in a cult and that everyone else has the wrong definition of what you're doing. But you also say that most of us don't realize how close we are, all of us, to being in some kind of cult-like organization. And we probably have all felt it. I mean, even whether it's following someone's diet program, it can be sort of a cult-like organization. What are the trappings of a cult? You know, how do we first identify those for ourselves?
Yeah, so, you know, I've kind of devoted my life to studying and understanding this because, you know, I say cults do some things right, which is they give you motivation, they give you a mission, and they give you this strong sense of community. And as you mentioned, those are all things that humans are really, really looking for. And another thing that cults do is they give you clarity. Right? Like everyone around you is doing the same thing. And that's why we see it pop up during confusing times. Two of the things, you know, there's all these complicated models on how to understand cults. And I think it's less important about naming a group a cult, but just seeing where these things are that can lead to toxic power in groups. And so two of the things I tell people is one, how much of your time is it taking up? Because if you're putting all of your free time, your free brain time into one thing, it can be a cult, right? I love Brené Brown, but if all I do is listen to Brené Brown 100 hours a week, I might be in the cult of Brené Brown. And so how much time are you putting in and how much free time do you have for other things? That can be a really important balance. And then the second thing is, what are the exit costs, right? And that's not always just the fee you have to pay for leaving your gym, right? Sometimes that's losing friends, losing family, losing face, right? If you've gone out really hard on some mission and then you come back and you say, oh, I was wrong. It's really embarrassing. And that's the same reason a lot of people push through Army basic training, right? You don't want to go home embarrassed. You don't want to kind of lose the commitment. So I think if we look at time it takes and exit costs, those are two things that can help us determine whether the group that we are in is sort of becoming toxic for us or not.
That's very interesting. What about the cost of being in the group, in the organization that may be cult-like, when you start to lose friends, family, and that sort of thing? I'm thinking right now in particular about QAnon, for example, and how many people that I've heard of that are have been within, I think it's kind of dying out now, but within that organization and saying, none of my family will speak to me. So there are costs of being inside it as well.
Yes. And I think, you know, these are important things to look at, is that cults always kind of require self-sublimation or self-sacrifice in some way. And also, any group that is trying to sort of control your information, so control what you're reading or control your kind of disfellowship with other people, that can be, you know, a sign of that, because cults like seriously rely on information, right? It always starts off with some good mission. Even, you know, a lot of people got into QAnon because they wanted to stop sex trafficking of children, right? A lot of my people got into QAnon because they wanted to stop sex trafficking of children. And then you get into these groups and you become so isolated that if the logic breaks down, doesn't always break down, but if it breaks down, you can't tell. And so definitely for me, big warning signs with any kind of group is if they tell you to stop associating with some people, or even just like you're so obsessed with your membership in the group that you stop associating with some people, that can be a danger sign.
This is really shedding a light for me on military in general around the world. And I've never thought of it as a cult. I've thought of it more as a service to your country and protecting your country and making sure that everyone is safe within the country because of the mission of the military. And it, as you're breaking it out, you know, you're fed a certain diet of this information that the government wants you to know so that you continue to serve that mission. And you talk a lot about your, you know, the cult of the U.S. Army or the military for that fact and how it's parallel in that sense. And we've heard these things in the news about individuals, you know, specifically females getting harassed and having these, is it getting better? Is the government taking strides, or are they kind of burying it in the information they feed the public?
So I think a little bit of both. You know, I think when we look at what the military does, the thing I want people to look at is like, we are programming our members. We are programming humans to conduct violence on behalf of state. And that programming is done in a very specific way. What happens with women is we stand out. We automatically stand out because we're still less than 20% of the population. And your number one job in the military or in any kind of high control group is don't stand out. So that right there already becomes very difficult. I think there are some things that have gotten better, like the Court of Appeals just declared that rape should not be considered incidental to military service, meaning service members can now sue for certain things related to sexual assault. But there are other things that I would expect to see if the military really wanted to change the culture for women. And those would be things like not fighting against Congress every time they try to remove sexual assault and harassment prosecution from the chain of command, or, you know, creating advisory boards for the battalion commanders out of young privates, young lieutenants, civilians that don't answer to them, right? That are able to say, this is what it's really like for us. It doesn't need to be this way. Because that's, you know, a big problem is this attitude of like, you wanted to be here, so be grateful that we let you be here and put up with everything. And that was, you know, to me, the most surprising thing in the military. Like, I expected the sort of echoes of cult behavior just because of knowing what kind of high control group the Army is and needs to be. But the parallels of like sexual danger, sexual violence, and just the misogynistic way that women are treated, I'm not sure it's getting better.
It's just gut-wrenching and sickening, and it just irritates the heck out of you when you think about it. And your journey is so incredible. And the fact that you're here talking about it is, I'm sure it's regaining some of your power back. But with PTSD, I'm sure it's something that filters and surfaces every now and then for you, or maybe every day. And so for individuals, you know, other women and that, or, you know, young men that have been out in these cults and been subjected to this type of behavior, and they're, you know, they might be listening or reading your story, where can they reach out? Can they do to help with these feelings and, you know, sharing their story as well?
Yeah. So both of those things are important. You know, if you ever are struggling with suicidal ideology, call a suicide hotline, or call if you have a friend, you know, that's been there. You know, one of the most helpful things I was told during my decade of struggling really hard with suicidal ideology was just, you know, when you're in the, it comes moments at a time. So when you're in those moments, just try to remind yourself that you do want to be alive and try to think of something you look forward to, and then reach out and get help. And that's, you know, the other thing for me, and I think for all sufferers of PTSD, is that the way we survive the actual trauma is by telling ourselves it's not that bad. Other people have been through worse. But the way we get over the trauma is by starting to talk about it and starting to hear those echoes of what has happened to us, happened to other people. Reading other people's memoirs has been a huge thing for me, right? And like seeing what that path is to go from trauma, which I think we all have in some way, to growth, you know? And it's, the trauma's never gone. We're always still going to deal with it, but it can become, you know, something manageable.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Daniela Mastinick-Young. She's written a new book called Uncultured. It's her memoir of growing up in a cult, the Children of God, her escape, her expansion with education, and then her time in the U.S. Army. So let's back up just a moment and go back to when you were, was it 15 years old when you escaped from this cult that you were born into? And then you go on to become valedictorian of your college class. You put yourself through high school and college, and you enter the U.S. Army. Talk to us first about the escape and the kind of three rules of how you sort of break out of this grasp.
Yeah, so I always say that leaving a cult, there's like three stages that everyone has to go through. And the first is when you have the crack in the brainwashing and kind of you actually leave. For me, that happened really strongly on 9/11. And I was 14 years old and I was seeing live TV on for the first time. And I was hearing, you know, my people that had always taught us America was evil and was going to be punished. And they were praising God. And here was the judgment we've been waiting for. And I'm seeing, you know, thousands of people dying, and I'm hearing the term religious extremism. And I think to myself, oh, maybe we're the religious extremists, you know, and people get to that point where their cognitive dissonance just can't explain it anymore. So then I left, right? And then I basically started a campaign of just being so bad that they wanted me gone. And I got excommunicated. I got dropped off in Houston with an older stepsister. I feel like it was probably like when Harry Potter went to Hogwarts, you know, like that's a good kind of analogy of how I felt. Like I was very excited to be gone, but I also had no clue and was very, very overwhelmed by the world. And school was just an easy thing to throw yourself into. And that, you know, brings me to the second part of leaving a cult, which I think takes like a decade or two. And that's just understanding, you know, why you were in a cult and then what impacts it had on you. And for me, of course, I was born into the cult. My mother was born into the cult. So I study systems and systems of power. And the third phase is where I'm at right now, and also where I think a lot of us in the country are at right now, which is once you sort of realize that your models are toxic, once you've rejected what you have been raised to believe, you have to go forward, but you have no models. And so that is, I think, at once very challenging, but for me, it was also very kind of broadening and opening, because it forces me every decision I make to think, you know, where does this come from? Why do I believe this? Go back, learn more, and, you know, go forward with what I assess to be the best path instead of just kind of blindly following what culture tells me to do.
Wow. Well, I wanted to ask you today, in this age of coddling our children are growing up entitled and not very resilient. And this is a big, you know, a big word is resilience. You learned resilience to the nth degree. And I'm wondering now, you know, you're bringing up your daughter in a world very different from the one that you grew up in. And yet you, you know, by age 15, you're out on the streets by yourself. You were very resilient. Is this something that you think about with your daughter? Like you're bringing her up in such a relatively easy world.
I do think about it, but I also think that maybe the way we always glorify trauma a little bit is problematic, and that, you know, yes, trauma made me stronger, and yes, I've survived so much and I've been able to do incredible things, but I would go back and trade it for a childhood or for my mom to have been able to have a childhood. And so, you know, for sure, my daughter has a much easier life, and it's a bit triggering to parent when you didn't really have, you know, any of that experience. But I think it's kind of just, I'm learning about the world as she's learning about the world. So I think she's probably gaining some resiliency just by going through this process with me. It is definitely frustrating that she doesn't have a good little soldier mode to snap into. And that for me is hard as a parent, because I was taught to, you know, line up. And my child questions everything and wants to know everything. And I love it.
I love that your child gets that kind of experience. I'm like, so I want to hear about your mom and what was your mom's journey? How did she break out as well? And where is she now?
Yes. So she's out of the cult. She lives in Texas, and she got the one associate's degree that you can get and make a ton of money with, which is court reporting. And she's doing quite well, but you know, she had seven kids in 14 years, total of 8 children. And so, you know, I grew up watching her most of her life, just kind of having babies and not being even allowed to care for them. Eventually she had a daughter with spina bifida, which is a very serious disability. And there was a medical concern when my little sister was about 6 years old. And the cult was very anti-doctor. And my mom was being told to trust God and go with the plan, all of these thought-stopping cliches that cults like to use. And she finally had had enough. And she said, nope, I'm taking my daughter. So she got on a flight to Houston from their commune in Mexico, just on her own, and checked into the children's hospital. And that also, she made that into her break with the cult. So she just never went back. And she had my dad, her husband, bring the kids, and they just left. And I told her the thing about 10 years, like, it's going to take you 10 years. And she said that was very helpful.
When you break out of these, though, and she takes off to, I mean, is there's no repercussion, or is it truly just a flee to get out of this situation? There's a choice when you break that cult mentality that you're able to go? Or I'm sorry, I don't understand that.
I mean, yeah, for the most part in this cult, they would let you leave when you wanted to leave. And that was one of their pieces of proof that they weren't a cult, for example, right? Is anyone's free to leave when they want to leave. But, you know, in my mom's situation, she'd spent 39 years in this world. It was all she knew. Her dad, who she loves very much, my grandfather, still runs the money for this organization, right? So I feel like there's a very possible and losing everything she's known for the past 40 years. And then, of course, you know, landing in the U.S. with 7 children, a handicapped child, and a husband, and no work history, no, you know, ability to earn money. Definitely very challenging. Like, I'm so impressed that she was able to do that.
Daniela, before we let you go, I'm just wondering if I'm doing my math right, you left about 10 years before your mom left. Is that right?
About 8 years, I think.
About 8 years. Okay. And so you had 8 years of just making your own way through the world. It's just amazing to me. Like, how did you make money? How did you get into college? How did you even pay for food as a 15-year-old on your own?
Yeah. So I had, you know, at some point the cult married my 20-year-old mom off to a 40-year-old uncle, and he had 7 children already. And so when I, at 15, was getting out of there, because at 16, you start having babies. So I needed to get out. And one of my stepsisters, who I really didn't know, agreed to let me come, you know, live in her apartment. When I went up to, you know, the high school with my social security card and passport to enroll, and the secretary was like, we can't enroll you. You don't exist. So it was very challenging trying to get a job. You know, I did spend 3 weeks in America with $0 and finally got hired at Chick-fil-A. And eventually I was a clerk at a law firm, and I did all of that while doing high school in 2 years, and then ended up getting scholarships for college, right? I got so lucky that a counselor noticed me, and there was this essay you have to write called What Makes You Different. And I was like, okay, I'm going for it. You know, I was raised in a cult, and I was able to get, you know, some help and get into college. But I do think that one of the things that drove me to the Army was that 7 years by myself in America, you know, doing very well scholastically, but otherwise sort of floundering socially, never feeling like I fit, never feeling like, you know, I had a structure, or I had a path. And then going and commissioning into the military as an intelligence officer, like, that's great. I just get through training and then I put on a uniform. I'm immediately part of a team. There's someone telling me what to do. And I knew I could excel in that world. So now, you know, 10 years later, I think it's very interesting how those two things went together.
Absolutely. Well, the book is Uncultured. It's a memoir by Daniela Mestinick-Young. And I just have to know this because so many people have read the book Educated. And you said hearing other people tell their stories. I'm just curious if that was one.
So I spent 10 years, I say, like, figuring out what book I didn't want to write, because I didn't just want to write like your traditional cult memoir or army story. And when I heard Educated, where, you know, she tells her story, but there's these very deep ideas that matter to everyone braided through, my first thought was, why didn't I write that book first? And then I said, there's my model. And I started going, and I got a lot of naysayers. You know, Educated was very popular, but eventually now Uncultured does get compared to Educated. And I'm happy with that. That story was like a huge guidepost for my life. So,
well, right. And it tells the rest of us that there's not just one person with that story. There are a lot of people with that story. And we appreciate your joining us, and your spirit is amazing, and the will that you have. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Lynn. You know, one of the turning points for me in my life story, and it's in the book, was somebody told me, you know, Daniela, you're not as different as you think you are. Like, get over yourself. And that, right, is the experience of reading Educated. And I think that is what we get from these memoirs. And I love to say that to other trauma survivors, right? You're not as different as you think you are, even if the details are different. Getting through these experiences and the way we heal and the way we group afterwards is, you know, such an important part of living with our traumas.
It's an important story. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Well, in 1993, local park guy David Bells bought an old building on Woodside Avenue. It was an old auto shop which served the high school students and other community members who might need to change their oil or redo their brakes. Fast forward to 1996. David did a full remodel on the shop, and it became The Shop Yoga Studio. David Bells joins us in the studio now, along with Sophia Maletti, who is a yogini and who is organizing yoga teachers to reopen the shop, which closed, I understand, about the time of COVID. So David Bells, Sophia Maletti, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Great to have you both. Well, let's go back to 1993, and when you bought the shop, what did it look like?
It was all boarded up. It had a Jess Reed, shameless plug, sign out on the front for 9 years. It had been for sale for 9 years, but not only was it boarded up, but so was the high school next door. And I looked at it and went, wow, you know, this is amazing, right? I had been going to college in Berkeley, and I thought of the warehouses in San Francisco, and I said, right here in the middle of town. And I was amazed it had just been sitting there.
And you were an architect, correct?
I am.
And still are. And so, of course, if you had that, it was almost like you had vision, you know, you were looking ahead to something that we now really appreciate. But like you said, if you lived in New York City or in Berkeley, you saw those warehouses and how amazing they could be, huh?
Absolutely. I was just like, wow.
Yeah. So you opened doors in 1996.
Yes, officially we finished up in the fall of 96 and had workshops and had our first David Swenson workshop in April of 97. And
How was the progression of the growth of the shop? Because I would imagine that in 96, you're kind of ahead of your time in the world of yoga and this natural spiritual healing world. Mm-hmm. Am I incorrect with that, or was it a big hit right out of the gate?
Well, yoga was not a big thing. And at that time, Mary Wilson and who was Mary? There was another Mary, not your mom, that they were the only two people teaching yoga here in town. And it was relatively more modest. You know, I was doing some martial arts back at that time, and when I first moved here, I was teaching karate at what was Prospector, which is now Silver Mountain. And so when I saw this building, I saw it as an amazing venue that could accommodate karate, yoga, and my architecture practice as a all-in-one.
And what about you, Sophia? When did you get into yoga, and when did you kind of become affiliated with the shop?
Honestly, I took my very first yoga class there. Yeah, so
as a 12-year-old.
I was actually living across the street, 1150 Park Ave. And so it was really convenient to just walk across the street, go to yoga with my girlfriends. And yeah, so that's where I first discovered the practice, and it's an Anusara studio, so there's more of a spiritual element, there's depth in the practice, and so I was drawn to that, and just never turned back. So started as a student, and then I did my first teacher training with Tiffany Wood.
Well, certainly David Windsor and I were talking about this before the show, saying how there's something about the space. Whenever I have been in there to do yoga classes, it envelops me in the space, the aesthetic there. It makes it a much more full spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, Sophia, if that is why you chose to come back and put together this collective to get the shop reopened.
Well, I'll correct you there. It wasn't just me. So all of the teachers, we were yearning to not just reopen, but I think that was one of the silver linings of the pandemic, is that it created a lot of depth and community and awareness around how important community is, really, for healing and just for living full lives. And so. There's 9 of us that were teaching there when everything shut down, and we all ended up becoming Zoom yoga teachers, which is not my favorite, but it was a nice pivot. I'm glad it was available for us. But yeah, so we just decided that the place is too special, and the community that it serves, and like you're speaking of, just the way you feel when you're there. There's something about the space. It's just a beautiful container for the practice, for coming together, for events, for all the things that we love to do there. And so we all agreed that it was too important to just, there was a sense of urgency. We needed to mobilize. And so we created this teachers collective, the 9 of us there. Just to kind of get organized and to make sure that David's needs were getting met, that the community's needs were going to be met, and that everybody was just kind of on the same page, right? Mm.
If I could add that one of the things that Sophia touches on, I think, is what really distinguishes us from most yoga studios around the country as well as Park City, and that is that most of them are fundamentally a physical practice. And though we do use the microcosm of the body as one of the tools on how we access an experience of something bigger, it is fundamentally a spiritual practice, as is in my book, martial arts, when you get active in that. And so whereas I think we're probably one of the only not hot yoga studios in town, which is a blessing for many of us. And I just think it's important. It is a sanctuary. And the magic of the aesthetic, which you identified, it really does go beyond that. There is energetically beyond aesthetics that spirit is present, mm-hmm. and that is what we're trying to connect with more fully. We're already connected. We just want to be able to experience that connection.
David Bells, you came from karate, as you say, into the yoga world. I don't know how you get to the point where you're considered either a yogi or a yogini. Maybe you could talk about that and your experience of coming to it. I have seen you do a handstand, so I know you are quite a yoga master. So tell us the story, if you would.
Anyone who practices yoga or is a yogini or a yogi.
Okay.
And first off, you know, so it's just an adjective in that way or a pronoun, I don't know. but for me, martial arts had always been more about how it made me feel, and I started into yoga as a cross-training, if you will, to my martial arts to increase my flexibility. And so I started with Ashtanga, as many people in Anusara had. And at a certain point, some fate stepped in and someone called me and said, hey, John Friend's coming to town. Would you like to host the workshop there? And I said, sure.
You said, who's John Friend?
Exactly. And I had actually heard of him because I had been going to Yoga Journal Conference in Estes Park, and he had been there often and never really connected with him. But starting at that point, magical things started to happen energetically and everything. And I ran into him, and his first workshop there was October of 99. And at just before that, in September, was the Yoga Journal Conference. And without getting into too much detail, I was feeling the energy in a very dramatic and ecstatic way at Estes Park. And then when he came here, there were many of us that just got blasted out of our socks. It wasn't a physical practice. There was energy moving, Shakti, Kundalini, whatever you want to call it.
So you keep alluding to the physical practice and the spiritual practice and how you're one of the only non-hot yoga studios in Park City. And I'm curious if have we taken yoga now to more of like an athletic pursuit and getting our sweat on, getting our workout versus losing that spiritual practice? And what is the difference between doing a hot yoga more versus a more spiritual type class?
I mean, if you're moving your body, that is, you're honoring something, you're honoring the divine, right? So if you are in your body and you're moving your body and you love it and it makes you feel good, that's a spiritual practice, whether or not you want to accept it or admit it, you know? So I think that it's, you know, all of the yoga studios, anything that is providing the community an opportunity to be in their body and move is a gift. So I want to say that first, but some yoga teachers and some yoga studios are just more focused on the physical practice, and that's fine. I think that what we offer here at the shop is the opportunity to go a little bit deeper and explore that side of the practice. So, I mean, it's, you know, yoga is many, many layers of experiences. And so if you're interested and you first start to scratch the surface at a hot yoga studio and you feel how amazing it feels in your body, and then you kind of keep traveling down the rabbit hole and then start to learn more about the other offerings, that's wonderful. But I don't think we should diminish the value of a hot yoga studio, because right?
Yeah. Many people, just as I had my first starts in Ashtanga, and then it led to an experience of something more that was like a calling card for me to want to investigate further, what's that about? Mm-hmm. And what can I do to access that more? And that's the way it happens with, you know, whether they're doing Bikrams or any other hot yoga, you know, they start there, and that may be where they find. And it, like Sophia said, you know, if it makes you feel better, that is perfect. Mm-hmm. Everyone's where they're supposed to be, and that's perfect.
Well, I love what you said, Sophia. If you move your body, that is a spiritual practice, and that's something I'm going to take away from this interview for sure, that if I'm out there in nature just going for a hike, that's a spiritual practice, and that's something to remember for all of us.
Yeah, and then just also just remembering that, I mean, you know, being in these bodies in this life on this planet is such a gift, and so if you acknowledge that by being outside and going for a run or skiing or just being walking in nature, that is an offering to say thank you, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're really excited to reopen.
Yes.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Sophia Maletti, yoga teacher, along with David Bells, the owner of the Shop Yoga Studio. They're talking about the reopening. And the hiatus, I suppose, started off with a pandemic. Everyone closed down, as you say, Sophia. Everyone went online, and you just haven't gotten back to that point of feeling like you were ready to reopen. What's the process?
I think it had a lot to do with, so we were a donation-based studio before.
For 20 years.
Wow. And David has been gracious and generous over the years, and we've decided to shift that business model. So we're now going to be using Wellness Living. So one of the software platforms like that many of the other studios are using, we will have everyone sign up with Wellness Living. We're going to be more like a traditional yoga studio when it comes to that.
The business side.
We're not. Yeah. It's no longer the glass bowl with the $5, $10, $20 bills in the glass bowl. Right.
It's hard to pay your yoga teachers with when bills don't get deposited into the bowl, right?
So that's one of the changes. We're shifting kind of business models, business plans. But just treating it more of a business, right? And it's still a community center, though, right? Mm-hmm.
As a part of that, what we hope to be doing, because it is such an amazing space with such an amazing energy in there, is that we do hope to be doing more events. So we've had bat mitzvah parties, weddings, and all this stuff in the past, but we want to, you know, meetings and all sorts of other community type events that can help provide income that to help support the thing. Just doing the utilities and property tax alone is crazy in itself. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a way to try and get the numbers to balance out a little bit better.
Yes, that makes sense. I know as long as I can remember during the Sundance Film Festival, the Shop has been, you know, completely taken over. Of course, they love the space too because it's so beautiful. So I'm assuming Sundance will be there again in January or?
No, this year they're not. They were hoping to, but they have, COVID has affected their books and everything else, and they didn't have the funds to activate the space this year. So, and before Sundance started using it over the last 7 years for the whole festival, I was doing more one-off events during Sundance, and then I would give Sundance the space for 1 or 2 days a year during the festival, just as a gratitude for them bringing the festival to town. And so at least this year, we may end up hopefully with someone else that will use the space during the term, but that hopefully moving forward, Sundance will be able to step back in there and we'll be able to continue our relationship with them.
Could you walk us through your membership model and for our listeners and what they can expect to come as a member of the Shop Studio and what it's going to cost and how they can access that?
So, well, first I want everyone to go to the website and sign up for the newsletter because all of those details will be in the newsletter. So if you go to the website, it's parkcityyoga.com, sign up for the newsletter, you will get all of the updates on the reopening and all the little details when it comes to the punch passes. The $10, you can buy a 10 punch pass, 20 punch pass. We'll have some, you know, discounts and offerings for first responders, so on and so forth. I think we're even doing it for teachers. Don't hold me to that, but And so just like wellness living, you know, we use wellness living at Enlightened Wellness as well, which is where another studio where I work here in town. If you already have a profile with wellness living, you'll use your existing profile, right? And the classes will vary based on the punch pass that you choose, but they will be anywhere between $15 to $20, right? So a drop-in class is going to be a $20 drop-in. If you buy a punch pass, then, you know, the more classes you buy on your punch pass, the more you save, right? So yeah, that's how it works. It'll be just like the other studios in town.
Yeah.
On my drive over here, I was telling my wife I was headed to this interview, and she mentioned that she was going to do a sound bath with you guys. What is a sound bath?
So I do a lot of sound baths. I do one a week. These days I'm doing like 2 and 3 a week. But so it's sound healing usually involves crystal sound bowls. They're tuned to 442 hertz, which is the Schumann resonance. It's the same frequency as that the Earth vibrates at. There's a lot of anecdotal data that supports that these sound healings are healing and that they heal at a cellular level. But now there's a lot of more hard data, scientific data that supports that these bowls in particular are providing healing, right? So it's you play these beautiful bowls. At the very least, it's very relaxing, and it triggers your parasympathetic nervous system, puts you into a theta state, and allows you to relax. And so usually the participants lie down, and the sound practitioner plays the bowls and a handful of other instruments, and then it's a meditation, basically, and then you get up and sort of integrate the practice by talking about it, right? So we just did one at the shop on Sunday. I'm the Mountain Town Music now has a wellness initiative that I run, and so that's the other thing is we'd like to encourage some of these more wellness focused events at the shop. So if anybody has like a sound bath, and you know, if Stacy wants to reach out, if anybody wants to host a breathwork practice or anything like that, write us, and that's at info@parkcityyoga.com, and we can set you up with an event.
And as it pertains to that, we are also hoping to do a little bit more diversity in the offerings that we have at the, even though fundamentally it will be a yoga studio, I hope to get a Tai Chi class or a Qigong class in there. It's all about how can we better tune our being, both physically and energetically, so that we can hear the whispers of spirit and hopefully respond. Most of us hear a little bit, but we don't respond. And so it's about that. And so again, as Sophia was saying, if you're someone with a lot of experience in those areas, Tai Chi or Qigong, and are looking, then we would also consider talking with you about that as well.
We just have a couple minutes left, and we have used some vocabulary that we can't presume all of our listeners know. Ashtanga, Anusara, there are many yoga practitioners here, but tell us the difference define those.
In a nutshell, those are just different styles of yoga, and each style has a little bit different focus. Fundamentally, they're all supposed to be doing the same thing as a spiritual practice. Ashtanga is just a term for the yoga that Patabi Joyce founded, and it is the eightfold practice. But theirs is fundamentally a physical practice because they don't do much in terms of pranayama, which is breath work, or yantras and mantras, other things that we do to try and access. Anusara is a very alignment-based yoga that was founded by John Friend, and it takes a lot of the alignment that was done in Iyengar, his initial background, but he systematized it. So instead of different alignment cues for every pose, there's these universal principles of alignment. And no matter what pose you're in there, you want to generally work your shoulders up and back. You want to take your thighs back and apart. And it's learning how to do that in your body. And at the same time, while keeping the breath as a tool to connect all those pieces.
Well said. Sophia, when's the opening date?
So that'll be November 14th. 5:30, there will be a class, and we're inviting everyone to come. Please check in first on Wellness Living. Write us or call us. What's the studio number, David?
435-649-9339. You will get a message, but that message will be sent to us, and we will respond accordingly. As she mentioned the website, please note that right now we have a temporary landing page. The full website should be activated within the next week, I believe. And so it's going to have more and more information for you there.
Yeah, so check it, and we'll be posting the updated schedule there as well. But for now, November 14th, 5:30 p.m. will be that class. We will also encourage anybody who is coming to the class at 5:30, it's a 75-minute class, to go ahead and stay after so we can all catch up with you.
Great. Sophia Maletti, David Bells from the Shop Yoga Studio, thanks so much for coming uptown from down at 1167 Woodside. Is that
yes,
the address? 1167 Woodside Ave in Old Town, right next to the library. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks you
guys.
Lynn.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thanks.